Happy Friday, everyone. And I want to thank all of you who are supporting Into the Word financially. Anyone that wants to join in with that effort, all you have to do is write down the contact information you'll hear at the end of today's program, then send your one-time or ongoing gift of any amount to that address, and it will be used for the radio broadcast fees. Fridays, I also set this time aside to encourage you to love and good deeds, to not forsaking the assembling together of the saints. Everybody needs a home congregation where they can worship and fellowship and pray and praise and serve in the same location with the same people on a regular basis. If you don't have a home congregation, you need to go out there and find one. Get plugged in, stay plugged in. And of course, if you're actively looking right now and you're within driving distance of the Elkhart East building, we'd certainly invite you to come and check us out as a potential home. I want you to open back to the book of Zechariah. Remember that we are looking at some of the Old Testament passages that expand our information about the millennial period. It would appear that throughout many of these Old Testament prophecies, God didn't just simply talk about judgment. He wove into those warnings that there would be salvation at some future point offered through Jesus Christ, as we understand it now, and that this would eventually result in a time of peace and prosperity, a return to Eden, if you will, a return to God's original plan of being in His presence in a new earth and under a new heaven in which righteousness dwells. And so in a little bit, I'm going to try to apply some of those concepts to the millennial period mentioned in Revelation chapter 20. But we've got a couple more places to look at in the Old Testament. One is I want to kind of finish up some things here in Zechariah 14, and then real quick, we'll pop over to Zephaniah 3 and pull a few things in from there. But the really cool thing, I think, that comes out of Zechariah 14 is the one in verse 8. On that day, living waters shall flow out from Jerusalem, half of them to the eastern sea. That's currently referred to as the Dead Sea, the Salt Sea to these folks. Lake Asphaltitis to the Romans. And half of them to the western sea. That's the Med. And it shall continue in summer as in winter. And we know we've seen this river of the water of life cited in other places, particularly in Ezekiel. We'll see it again later in the book of Revelation. And this starts at the Temple Mount and goes east and west. The one that goes eastward passes through the new valley that we saw formed earlier in the book of Zechariah. And the idea that it continues summer as in winter shows that it is not one of those wet weather streams. It's not a creek. It is a full-fledged living river. And then verse 9, you got to love it. And he who is will be king over all the earth. On that day, he who is will be one, and his name one. And of course, we know that Jesus himself, as the Savior, as God made flesh, he will be the one seated upon the throne at Jerusalem in this new heaven and new earth. And his name is He Who Is Salvation. Then I was just starting to talk about this when we closed up. It says that the whole land shall be turned into a plain from Geba. We know where Geba is. It's just a few miles north of the Temple Mount. To Rimmon, which we don't know exactly where it is, but my suspicion is it's probably just a few miles south of the Temple Mount. So the whole land is going to be turned into a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem shall remain aloft on its site from the gate of Benjamin to the place of the former gate, to the corner gate, to the tower of Hananel, to the king's wine presses. Now, that those locations would make sense to the people reading the book of Zechariah the first time, which is in the time of returning from the exile, rebuilding the temple, and they know where the ruins of all these different gates and wall lines are. And eventually, good old Nehemiah is going to be commissioned to rebuild these walls. But from the perspective that we're looking at, apparently there will be some sort of walled city of Jerusalem in the millennial period. And it will have this huge, wide area around it, like a plateau. At the current moment, if you were to go and visit Jerusalem, it is defined by a whole bunch of valleys around or near the Temple Mount and between the mountains that are there. But in this time period, with the new heaven, new earth coming into existence at the second coming of Jesus, the topography changes. And I said to you as we were closing, my guess is that that is going to be more helpful in having a worship assembly area around Jerusalem for those special gathering times, like the Feast of Tabernacles every year, when you will have an immense number of people trying to be close to where Jesus is ruling and reigning from on the Temple Mount. And it will be inhabited from there, for there shall never again, notice that, that's an absolute statement, there shall never again be a decree of utter destruction. So from that line, we know that Zechariah's prophecy was not fulfilled by the Jews coming back from Assyrian and Babylonian exile and rebuilding the city of Jerusalem, because a decree of utter destruction happened again, which resulted in the destruction of the temple rebuilt by these guys. We've got the next big time is the second coming. That's when the next big gathering is going to take place of all his people to Jerusalem, and never again will there be a problem. Jerusalem shall dwell in security. And you should think of that in connection with the millennial period. Verse 12 is all about the plague. We've talked about this, that came upon the people during the Battle of Armageddon. But verse 16, and I want you to file this away to be used pretty soon. Then everyone who survives of all the nations that had come against Jerusalem, meaning the mortals who had not accepted the mark of the beast, but who were not themselves yet followers of Jesus, so they weren't resurrected and transformed, these are the millennial mortals that we're describing here. And so they shall go up year after year to worship the king, he who is over the armies. That's, again, God's military title in the Old Testament. And to keep the Feast of Booths, Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles, the feast that symbolized the fact that Israel was no longer in Egypt, they were no longer in the wilderness, they were in their promised land. And so they could take a few days out of every year and celebrate that with kind of a camping experience. And so this is going to be, I think, the annual commemoration of the start of the millennium. And so every year, every mortal and I think all the immortals as well, are expected to show up for this special appointment. And if they don't, there's a problem, and this is the part I definitely want you to file away. If any of the families of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem themselves to worship the king, he who is over the armies, there will be no rain on them. So if the family of Egypt, for example, does not go up and present themselves, then on them there shall be no rain. Now that should pique your interest, because there is no rain in Egypt. Historically, Egypt is a dry place, but in the new earth, it will get rain. Unless, of course, people in a certain area are not coming to the Feast of Tabernacles like they're supposed to do every year during the millennium. There shall be the plague with which, this is going to be the plague with which he who is afflicts the nation, nations that don't go up to keep the Feast of Booths. This shall be the punishment to Egypt and the punishment to all the nations that don't go up to keep the Feast of Booths. So God will turn the tap off. And it doesn't matter if you're living in a perfect earth with great soil and the plants are perfect and the sunlight is perfect and the temperature is perfect. If you get no rain, you're going to have a problem. And that is going to feed into what we're going to talk about with the end of the millennium in a bit. Verse 20. On that day, there shall be inscribed on the bells of the horses, which again is interesting because the Israelis were, by the direction of God, not all that connected with horses. Their animal of choice for working the fields and transporting things was the donkey and the ox, not horses. But in this new earth, there will be horses that are associated with these folks, and the bells that they're wearing for decoration, apparently, will say, Choresh LaYahweh. Now, if that sounds familiar, it's because that's the exact wording on the nameplate of the high priest. So the horses are going to be marked just like the high priest used to be. They belong to God. They're his special thing. And not just the horses. The pots in the house of the Lord shall be as the bowls before the altar, and every pot in Jerusalem and Judah will be Chodesh, holy, to he who is over the armies, so that all who sacrifice may come and take of them and boil the meat of the sacrifice in them. Now, that is the one place that I feel kind of weirded out in talking about this as being a millennial passage, because one of the things we've seen in other millennial passages, and we've seen it in more than two, so we've got the testimony of two or three witnesses to this, is that in the new heaven and new earth, there will be no more eating of meat. And because Jesus is the epitome of sacrifice, he is the ultimate sacrificial lamb, and he's already paid that price, there will be no need for sacrifices. And so I think it may be that we should just accept the thrust of the argument here from Zechariah, the explanation to the people of his day. And that was basically this. The temple was considered holy, and the pots and pans that were used in temple service were considered holy. But Zechariah is saying everybody's pots and pans are going to be holy in the new kingdom, in this new place, this new time, and that's how we should understand it. And there shall no longer be a trader which the English Standard and other English versions go with that. It's actually the word Canaanite, which should be understood as someone that's not holy, because that's the context here. Someone who is not part of God's kingdom. So there shall no longer be a non-holy person in the house of he who is of the hosts on that day. So basically, everybody that is there and showing up are supposed to be all in for God. So I'll be referencing back to a lot of those things in just a little bit. Let's grab a hold of Zephaniah is our last example of a millennial passage. It's Zephaniah chapter 3, verse number 6 says, I have cut off nations, their battlements are in ruins. I've laid waste their streets so that no one walks in them. Their cities have been made desolate, without a man, without an inhabitant. So this is a description of God's ultimate judgment and victory. I said, surely you will fear me. You will accept correction. Then your dwelling would not be cut off according to all that I've appointed against you, but all the more they were eager to make all their deeds corrupt. Therefore, verse 8, wait for me, declares he who is. And we've seen that idea of waiting for God to come. That's specifically thinking about Jesus. Therefore, wait for me, declares he who is, for the day when I rise up to seize the prey. For my decision is to gather nations, to assemble kingdoms, to pour out upon them my indignation, all my burning anger. For in the fire of my jealousy, all the earth shall be consumed. So that's a description of what we saw for the day of the Lord, climaxing in the Battle of Armageddon, when the last remnants of the beast leader and his kingdom are done in. Then verse 9, this is the millennial section. For at that time I will change the speech of the peoples to a pure speech, that all of them may call upon the name of he who is and serve them with one accord. So everybody's going to be on the same page, he says. From beyond the rivers of Cush. Cush is down south of Egypt. My worshipers, the daughters of my dispersed ones, shall bring my offering. So here we have another example of being gathered from the far-flung places. On that day, you shall not be put to shame because of the deeds by which you have rebelled against me. For then I will remove from your midst your proudly exultant ones, and you shall no longer be haughty in my holy mountain, but I will leave in your midst a people humble and lowly. That kind of echoes the idea we get from Peter, that we're looking for a new heaven and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. They shall seek refuge in the name of he who is, those who are left in Israel. They shall do no injustice and speak no lies, nor shall there be found in their mouth a deceitful tongue, for they shall graze and lie down, and none shall make them afraid. So here's the peace and prosperity again of the millennial period. And then a little singing again. We keep seeing that in a lot of these millennial passages. Sing aloud, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O Israel. Rejoice and exult with all your heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. He who is has taken away the judgments against you. He's cleared away your enemies. And of course, the biggest enemies would be sin and death. And Jesus conquered both. He conquered sin on his first coming. He conquers death on his second coming. The King of Israel, he who is in your midst, and you shall never again fear evil. That helps us understand this is a millennial passage. It's never going to be a problem amongst those in God's presence to ever be afraid again. On that day, It shall be said to Jerusalem, Fear not, O Zion, let not your hands grow weak. He who is your God is in your midst, a mighty one who will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will quiet you by his love. He will exult over you with loud singing. So God's going to be singing over us. I will gather those of you who mourn for the festival so that you will no longer suffer reproach. So this is basically people wanting the relationship with God, and they're sad when they can't have it. And God says, I'm going to fix that. Behold, at that time, I will deal with all your oppressors. So problem, troublemakers, gone. I will save the lame. So that's been taken care of with the resurrection, transformation, and the beginning of the new heavens and the new earth. I will gather the outcast. We've already seen that. Jesus sends his angels to collect all the people from one end of the world to the other. I will change their shame into praise and renown in all the earth. At that time, I will bring you in, at the time when I gather you together, for I will make you renowned and praised among all the peoples of the earth when I restore your fortunes before your eyes, says he who is. And so that is the last of our examples of great millennial promises from the Old Testament. And they all seem to focus on this idea that the earth will be changed at the second coming of Jesus. The old earth, old heaven, just falls apart, disappears, makes a big noise in the process, throws off a lot of heat in the process of unraveling. But it is immediately replaced with a new heaven and a new earth in which righteousness dwells and in which there is no death, no destruction, no problems, because all the troublemakers have been removed. Satan and his angels are out of the picture. All of the beast leaders, people who had gone against the idea of Jesus coming back as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, they're gone. Believers of all ages have been resurrected. They've been transformed. They've become the immortals who are in the administration of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, working with these mortals that we keep talking about that are going to be spending the 1,000 years making up their mind what to do with Jesus. And the animals will be at peace with people. People will be at peace with people. The curse is gone. We are in the Garden of Eden again, basically. We are back to where God wanted us to start in the first place. And this is one of the reasons, by the way, that I have a little bit of a problem with my amillennial friends. I used to be an amillennialist, but every once in a while I'll go back and I'll sample what they have to say about some of these things. And it just so happens I tuned in to one the other day, and they were mocking those of us that are literal premillennialists, and this is their reason that they were mocking, which I think is kind of sad. They were mocking premillennialists as being too materialistic, too caught up in the flesh, that they are looking for physical pleasures, and that is not what the millennium is all about. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, did you guys forget that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and he went through all this process over 6 days of creation, making a material world? And material plants, and material animals, and material people. And he looked at it each day and said, this is good, this is good, this is good. And then he made a Garden of Eden, and the word Eden there literally means pleasure. And that's where he put the first couple. And he said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, make it your home, enjoy the animals, enjoy the plants, enjoy my fellowship. And he said on that day, it is very good. And then he wrapped it all up. He finished his 7 days of creation by taking a day off. And we know also that before sin entered the world, God himself came walking, apparently in a material body of his own choosing, came and fellowshipped with Adam and Eve and the animals, I suppose, that were around them in that first creation. So why in the world would you mock the idea that we're going back to God's original plan? And that the millennium is just simply the first part of that eternal kingdom in a new earth with a new heaven overhead. And so I hope some of you that are still my amillennial friends, that I might be able to convince you to at least not make fun of those of us that believe in the literalness of the scripture, that there's good reason for us to take that tack. Well, we've only got a minute left, so let's set the stage for our next session next week by reading Revelation chapter 20, verse number 7, where it says, and when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan, only Satan, by the way, none of his other angels, just him, will be released from his prison, that is, the abyss, and he will come out to deceive the nations, which is a stand-in for the idea of the mortals, that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. And we will develop that idea of the run-up to the Battle of Gog-Magog next time we get into the Word.